Hi, this is WWR WinWise Radio.
WinWise Radio.
Hi, this is Harley Keisch.
And Susan Lockwood.
And we're coming to you from high atop a not-so-windy mountain in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts.
This week, we'll be returning to Vermont.
The focus will be on the ecology, the wildlife, and the habitat destruction that is going on due to intensive wind turbine development on Vermont's ridges.
With us, we will have Annette Smith, who is founder and executive director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment, and Susan Morse, who has more than 35 years' experience monitoring wildlife and interpreting wildlife habitat use.
Well, we're back again on a Sunday evening. Hi, Susan.
Hello, Harley.
Hello.
Hi. And with us, of course, are our guests. Sue, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome, welcome. And Annette?
Yes, hello. Good evening.
Hi, Annette. Good evening. Well, we're very happy to have you guys on.
Great.
So I think, Annette, if you could start just briefly, just the kind of overview of what the situation is in Vermont, what all the projects are, the current status of what's going on, how many are there, what's the lay of the land?
Okay. Well, Vermont has one older wind project that people, I think of when they think of wind turbines in Vermont, and that's the Searsburg project that was constructed in 1998. And that has 11 turbines. They're under 200 feet tall, and they are noisy for the people who live nearby. There aren't very many people who live nearby, but that I still think is what people think of. They're less than a megawatt. They're half a megawatt, actually, and they are less. You know, they don't have to have lights on.
Now, are those in the National Forest?
They are not on National Forest land. They are right next to the project called the Deerfield Wind Project, which I'll get to in a minute. So I'm going to sort of go chronologically. So we, as of last year, now have the Sheffield Wind Project, which is First Wind's there are 16 turbines there. They're 2.5 megawatts, and it started operating last November. That's the first big wind project that we have in Vermont, and they're 420-foot tall Clipper turbines that are 2.5 megawatts each. Under construction, and which now can't be discussed in Vermont media, which without being called the controversial Lowell Wind Project, is being, some people would call it construction. I think we'd be more inclined to call it destruction. Incredible devastation that we're seeing take place on the Lowell Mountains for that wind project. There are two other projects that have been approved by the Vermont Public Service Board. The Georgia Mountain Project, which is four 3-megawatt turbines. Those developers are having trouble right now. They can't seem to get it together, and they are under the gun to try and get it built by the end of the year. The other one that has been approved is what's called the Deerfield Wind Project. There is no Deerfield in Vermont. It's in the towns of Searsburg and Reedsboro, and it's sort of an extension of the existing Searsburg project. But those turbines would be more than twice as tall. It's, I think, 410 feet tall, although this is on U.S. Forest Service land, and it is the Forest Service approved 380-foot turbine, so I'm not sure why the discrepancy. That project would be 15 turbines within less than 2 miles of the George D. Aiken Wilderness, and you would see the tall rotating turbines and the lighting from within the wilderness. Then there are some historic projects. There was East Haven and Glebe Mountain and Manchester, which have just kind of been hanging out for a while, and people are still worried they're going to come back, and the developers have come back from time to time to promote them some more, but those go back to about 2005 or even earlier. And then we've got some coming along that the developers are claiming they're going to file this year, and that one is called Grandpa's Knob, which is in Rutland County, and they've hooked up with Nordex. That's a Reunion Power project. And then there is one way up in the Northeast Kingdom in the towns of Brighton, Ferdinand, and Newark. And that one, they just submitted an application for 4 Met Towers, talking about filing at the end of the year. So we have a lot of activity, and it's all over the state.
Well, there is a lot of activity, it sounds like. So when did you first get involved with the struggle to try to make some rational choices about wind power development there?
Well, my organization, Vermonters for a Clean Environment, works on a lot of different issues, and we were not asked to get involved in the wind issue until 2009, when a developer was proposing what was then the largest project in Vermont, in Ira, Vermont, that would have been on land owned by Yale Endowment. And so I've been working on this issue now for 3 years. And actually, it's not the most difficult subject I'm currently working on. The most difficult one has to do with the disinfection of municipal drinking water. But this one is, in many ways, very extreme, in that there's no middle ground. There's a lot of spin on both sides. And so it has been really challenging to try and find the facts and to assist the public in participating in what is Vermont, not a very good process for public participation, and to have a say in what goes on in their communities.
So has it been difficult for you personally being on the anti-wind side? Like, have you gotten a lot of negative feedback from people in the environmental community?
It's not the worst abuse I've ever taken. Well, I was involved in fighting a very large multinational mining company that wanted to open a new mine a mile from my house. And when these things are, like, close or in your backyard, it is personally much more difficult. And for 4 years, I actually brought my mailbox home because people would steal it, put like, really pile rocks on it, crush it. So I'm very happy I don't have to bring my mailbox home. Now, in terms
they
of the
really
environmental community, yeah, yeah. Well, I was glad they took it out on the mailbox, actually. So I just, didn't play the game. I just brought it home, so there wasn't. And so in the morning, I'd take it up when I got my paper in, and afternoon when I got the mail, I'd bring the mailbox home. You have to sort of cope with whatever's thrown at you. But in the environmental community, it's a more of a level of intolerance, and so the sort of abuse that I've gotten was when I first started looking at the issue, where people would just say, oh, come on, you're just anti-wind. Well, as a matter of fact, in the work that we do, we don't even have to take positions to assist citizens in having a say in what goes on in their communities and holding corporations accountable for what they do. But it can get ugly, but it actually hasn't been that ugly, because the interesting thing about what's going on in Vermont is that the other side actually just doesn't want to engage. They're quite happy to go along and try and get the policies to support big wind development. And I can almost hear the governor saying to everybody, don't talk about it, just do it. And so that's where we are. We aren't having the conversation that a lot of other states are having.
Yeah.
Now,
is that your experience also, Sue?
Well, I'm almost nervous to say this, I guess, because I don't want to misrepresent anything, but it just seems to me like our agencies whose work it is, whose great noble work it is to help us conserve and protect our natural resources, they just seem muzzled to me. They, they're coming out against wind in some places, but on the whole, I just don't see, I'm not hearing the biologists say as much as they should be saying about this, and I find that very troubling. And of course, the citizens could barely get a word in edgewise. I mean, thank God for Vermonters for a Clean Environment and Energize Vermont, because they're two very powerful ways that we can get involved and can try to be heard. But the process really isn't very friendly now to those of us who are opposed to this for reasons I can't really quite wrap my mind
now,
around.
Sue, when did you start to get involved in this? I mean, can you describe a little
of
that?
Well, a little more than a year ago. Is that correct, Annette? Annette asked me a little more than a year ago to weigh in on what I thought, and I held forth and told her that I was very concerned about the effect of wind facilities on bats and songbirds, for example, where we have lots and lots of data and real rather sobering statistics on the damages that can come about as a result of this. And so I shared that with her, and of course in the context I voiced my own personal conviction that, for heaven's sakes, in light of this just awful, awful, disastrous pandemic of white nose syndrome, a fungal disease that's killing bats by the thousands, well over a million bats in our region have been killed thus far, you know, the worst disease of its kind, in fact, bats in North American history, we can ill afford to be, you know, condoning this sort of thing. And for what? I mean, the returns are negligible, and I mean, Annette can give you the figures on that, but I mean, what we're going to get from these facilities is negligible in terms of our alleged reduction of our global warming footprint. Really, we'd be far better off to do a lot of other things first.
Now, Annette, can you run through some of those numbers? I mean, what do you think the impact is on
in terms
like
of
carbon
what?
Dioxide reduction or any of that?
Well, no, I can't, because I really haven't seen any statistics. All I can tell you is that we're supposed to believe. And so I am actually somebody who relies on research. I'm a researcher, and I've spent 3 years trying to understand, will building big wind turbines on top of our mountains make a difference? And we are in the New England grid. Last year, I was at a Department of Energy-sponsored workshop where there were two men there, one who was the operations manager for ISO New England, that's the independent system operator in New England, and another man who was a grid expert. And they said, well, we have about 300 megawatts of wind on the grid in New England, and by the end of the year, we're going to have about 500 megawatts. And for us, it's just noise. Now, that sort of what we don't know about the New England grid is, because the wind interacts primarily with natural gas plants. So when the wind is blowing, that means that they have to scale back the natural gas plants. So they turn them down or they turn them off, and then it's the plant cycle. So we don't know whether the wind energy that we've got in the grid is reducing greenhouse gas emissions, or if, like driving in traffic, when you turn the gas plants up and down, whether that's actually resulting in increasing greenhouse gas emissions. So while wind supporters believe, and they say, I have to believe, I'd like to see some evidence, and I haven't seen it.
Well, clearly we know that the greatest impact that Weaver monitors are causing with respect to global climate changes is how we heat our homes and all the driving we do, especially Vermonters that live in rural areas and commute to other areas. I mean, the single operation vehicle folks, and myself included. So we are really contributing enormously to global climate change. And that, it seems to me, is what has got to change. I would hope and pray, in fact, that our political leadership, both in Washington and Montpelier, would really lead us to those conclusions and really aggressively support Vermonters that want to improve their efficiencies, both in their homes and in the way they travel, in terms of heating and moving about the landscape. And I just don't see as much of that as I'd like to. I mean, Vermont's energy plan launched by the new governor it's got some brave moments where some of that is discussed. But, you know, on the ground, I really want to see a whole lot more of that than I'm seeing. And I hope I'm not throwing stones at a glass house, but I, you know, I get around and I don't see much. And I know I've just done some personal energy improvement in my own home, and I'm not being touched by government in a way that helps me appreciate how I might be helped with a modest income for doing that sort of work. Not that I'm looking for a handout, but I think a lot of Vermonters deserve that handout if that's what we're doing. I'd rather see federal dollars, for example, invested in people making personal change, both in how they travel and how they improve their homes to retain the energy that we're using, than still more industry infrastructure in wildlands that we have darn little of in our region. really.
Well, of course, Sue, what the plan is that we're all going to drive electric vehicles. And that is going, they're going to be fueled by wind energy, which will charge our vehicles since the wind primarily blows at night. And that's when there is very little load. Then the plan is that that will charge the electric car batteries. And I really would like to believe in that. I mean, I live off grid and I've lived off grid for more than 20 years in Vermont with solar, and I drive a hybrid, but I am watching what's going on with the electric car business, and we're a long way from being
there.
I'm sorry. It's just, that's the reality. As much as I want to believe, I think that we are, you know, it only takes 8 months to put up these big wind turbines. And I think that we're not in the next year, we're not all going to be buying electric cars. And so we are way ahead of ourselves on that one.
So,
well, again, I just to support what you've just said, but with a different perspective, I want to see Vermonters and folks throughout New England get supported for making the personal choices and sacrifices that we really need to do. When we really look at the impacts of global climate change worldwide, we are looking at major sacrifices, whether we like it or not. That's not a popular theme in today's politics, but that's what we're looking at. And it is likely to be disastrous no matter what we do. It is already disastrous if you look at the storm events of just this year that have, you know, fivefold increase of major, major billion-dollar damaging storms all over North America. It's a wake-up call, but I just don't know how many people are really being helped to wake up. And there's where I look to government to lead us. I look to our agencies to really, and our politicians to really get to work on that. And I'm not seeing much.
Well, speaking of impact from storms and runoff and such, when we were in Vermont a couple weeks ago, we were speaking with Steve Wright and Jeff Gall and Luke Snelling, and they were talking about how disastrous it is when you put a wind farm on top of a mountaintop, because you're destroying the hydrology and you're opening the surrounding countryside up to really severe floods. Do you guys, either of you, have anything to add to that?
Well, we don't call them farms.
Bravo.
I worked before getting involved in this wind business. Vermonters for a Clean Environment's work was almost entirely on water. And what we are seeing approved by our state agencies and federal government on these wind projects is really shocking to me. Someone recently came up with a good way of helping people understand just what we're talking about. The Deerfield project, which is proposed for two ridgelines, which is on the hillside which is the watershed that goes into the Deerfield River, which is what flooded Wilmington, which was a really seriously impacted community, is the wind project that the U.S. Forest Service has approved for. That is the equivalent of putting two Walmarts up on the mountains. That's the amount of impervious surface that you're talking about. And in Lowell, we are seeing headwater streams fill. And when Jeff Gall provided comments to the state agency to say that, you know, you're filling 9 headwater streams, the state agency responded in their response summary by saying, we disagree that we're filling headwater streams will be filled. Well, now I'm getting the erosion prevention sediment control reports, and there's photos and captions that say this stream is being taken for the project. There's one road that's been put on top of 350 feet of the stream. This is not what I thought wind development was going to be about.
It's damn green. That's green. I like that. Oh, yeah.
Well, all in the name of green alternatives and independence and all of that. And that all has a nice positive ring to it. And I myself am persuaded that, you know, that Vermont should do anything we can do except ruin our environment to get green energy going and to make sacrifices and improve everything. But Not by doing that. That's just insane. I'm with Annette. I just don't get it. I don't understand what's driving it.
Well, and we are in a global water crisis, and so one of the things that I've done in the last few years is work with a couple of people and actually put out a book about water, and it's has a spiritual bent to it, and it is, you know, intended to help give some people hope and really think about water. And what we have in Vermont is some of the purest water on Earth. It is, our headwaters are on the tops of the mountains. These mountains are soaking wet, and they are filtering the water, and that's feeding the wetlands and streams. What we're doing here in Vermont with this rush to building wind projects is showing a tremendous disrespect for the water and not placing any value on it. And that's where I think we're really falling down, is by not taking the time to look at what values our mountains have in terms of wildlife habitat and water and how those contribute to climate change adaptation.
I want to talk about adaptation, and I want to do that. But I have a question about the general population there in Vermont. Is there widespread support for this development? I know there was some polling earlier, maybe a few years ago, and then some polling recently. Do you guys have a good feel for where that is?
No.
Yeah. I don't trust it. And Matt, if you'll recall the film that we recently did with Energize Vermont, you talked about how, in that film, you talked about how you were willing to go along with a poll that was made at that time, but you weren't given all the information. Do you recall that?
Yeah, I mean, I was in the room. It was called a deliberative polling process. There were probably 100 people there, and we actually had keypads, and so they gave us a bunch of information. And I recently, last year, got to actually see the slide that we were shown, and it did not show any impacts to water quality or water in any way, and really minimal impacts to wildlife. And so I was at a conference where I was able to ask the person who had put that presentation together for us when we did the polling several, it was like 5 years ago at least. And he said, well, it was intended to be relative. But I think it's really disingenuous to show no impacts to water in that context. So we were not given factual information, and back then we didn't have 450 foot tall wind turbines. You know, when you ask people generally, do you support wind turbines on ridgelines, people do not think about 450 foot tall machines with blinking lights, and they don't think about a million pounds of explosives creating roads there. I mean, it's just not what anybody could envision. I couldn't have envisioned what's happening up in Lowell.
Well, and I think the average citizen, you know, with all due respect, is not necessarily aware of these impacts to wildlife. They don't necessarily know, for example, that our wild ridgelands in Vermont and throughout New England, extending all the way to Massachusetts, are major preferred travel routes for wildlife, both locally and regionally. And it is along these ridgelines that wildlife disperse and seek new habitats of their own when young leave their mother's habitat, as they must. You know, these ridgelines are critically important for the long-term well-being of the wildlife that we all love in New England, no matter where you live. And I don't think the average person understands
now,
that.
So there are bobcat, right? What are all the species there's a huge biodiversity on your ridges, right? I mean, what is the?
Oh, of course, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you think of the moose that we all know and love in New England, including Massachusetts now and parts of Connecticut even. It is along these ridgelines, along our mountain spines from Maine through New Hampshire and Vermont and points south, that these animals travel, and moose are a great example. You know, if you want to see moose sign, go up on a ridgeline. If you want to see bear sign, go up on a ridgeline.
That's really interesting, because like moose, I guess the common conception about it, I hold it too, is that they're in the low-lying swampy areas, I mean, near a lake somewhere. That's my vision of it. But you're saying that they travel along the ridgelines.
Yeah, do. And, you know, and moose winter along our mountain habitats, not necessarily on top of the ridgeline, certainly, but farther up than people realize. I mean, they really are seeking out, especially in more southern habitats where they don't have these resources in the lower elevations to start with, like we do, for example, in the Northeast Kingdom or northern Vermont, northern New Hampshire. Moose will migrate elevationally into higher elevation habitats.
Oh, that's interesting.
Not that they're going to be on the highest terrain, but, you know, who's to say where these ridgeline power facilities are going to be proposed for over the next 20 years? Energy experts are saying, or not experts, but advocates, wind tower advocates are saying that we could have 200 linear miles of wind facilities on Vermont's mountains. Who's to say that all of them are going to be at certain elevations? In other words, what I'm trying to say is I worry very much about where wildlife are going to be able to have their absolute last-ditch sanctuary and movement.
Now, what does the science say about that? I mean, isn't there an emergent science of cumulative effects? And
oh yeah, well that is albeit a slowly developing phenomenon. It is the emerging science, if you will. It's called cumulative effects assessment, and that's another whole area where I feel Vermont is woefully undereducated, if you will, and I don't see any evidence at all that Vermont agencies are planning to really comprehensively assess the impacts of these facilities on wildlife. But the minute you go up into the north, for example, in the Arctic, Canadian Arctic and Alaska, that it's what's going on. I mean, cumulative effects are, if you will, a kind of aggregate of combined and often synergistic effects, which cascade through ecosystems and affect multiple species. And so these effects, are measured not just for what has happened in the past in response to an alteration of habitat or an installation of an energy facility or a diamond mine or all the things that we're doing up there. They're also looking at these effects, all the effects over time, past, present, and also predicting, statistically future impacts. And these effects are real. These large-scale habitat loss effects, alterations of habitat, and loss of habitat have what we call cumulative consequences. And, they affect the behavior of animals. They alter the behavior. They alter the way they want to use their habitat, the way they want to travel through their habitat. They certainly affect their comfort zone within habitat. Physiologically, they're impacted. That's been demonstrated. You know, countless dozens and dozens and dozens of papers worldwide are looking at that, impacting migrating species, for example. And then even distributional changes, the demographic changes. These animals often this research is demonstrating that these animals are often definitely experiencing reduced fitness as a consequence of costly energetic expenditures that they're having to run away from the roads and run away from the people, the snowmobiles and the hikers and skiers that are going to go up these power line facility roads. Who's to stop them? And these animals are having to expend energy at a time when they can ill afford it. And then avoidance of habitats that historically have provided them with optimal food and cover. That has cumulatively over time a negative impact on the animal's fitness, whether it's a moose or a bird. And so population declines have definitely been attributed to this sort of thing. Lowered reproductive rates, lowered recruitment success of the young. All of this. Right now, throughout all of North America, literally from Quebec all the way across to Alaska, caribou, for example, are definitely in a population plunge. Different species are declining, and it's being attributed to industrial energy exploration and actual installations, and also increasing roads in just a human presence on the land. Well, don't you think for 1 minute that's not going to happen at every one of these facilities in Vermont's tiny little last remaining, you know, ridgeline wildlands core? Of course it will. And I don't see any effort to even identify that, gee whiz, this is a science we should be embracing, and we should be stepping back before we do all these facilities. We should be demonstrating to ourselves that these ill effects won't happen. I just don't see
so that. I take it that means that there has not been a study on the impact on wildlife at the Searsburg site.
Oh, well, they did look at it, but it's a relatively small site. I mean, really, compared to what we're seeing in Sheffield and Lowell. And then, of course, the studies are being done by the wind industry. And so there's very low confidence in them. But what we're hearing in Vermont is that, well, we don't have time. We have the Bill McKibben and David Blittersdorf mantra that we don't have time to have the conversation. And our governor, Governor Shumlin, says the same thing, that... well, it doesn't matter about the animals up there because they're all going to die anyway, or that the trees, well, you know, the climate is changing so much that we're not going to have sugar maples after a while. And so really it doesn't matter what's up there because, and of course, if you try to talk about human health or if you try and talk about the animals, they'll say, well, far more damage is being done to our forests because of acid rain from coal power plants. And so everything is turned around so that to justify the wind resource and to justify not caring about what we have now.
Yeah, and I'll add to that by saying that I haven't heard anybody say that these animals are going to die anyway, so we shouldn't care. That's what I call a great unfulfilling prophecy, and I sure hope I don't hear anybody empowered to lead us say anything that's stupid. But I will say that I'm not hearing from my biologist colleagues in the agencies who really should be espousing these newer approaches to much, much more comprehensively understanding the impacts of what we do out there. And they certainly should be the first to know that, you know, with global climate change, these animals are going to take it in the shorts hard if we cut off all the ways in which they need to move about the larger landscape and respond to climate change in the first place. So, that's what I want to hear. I understand there's a bear research project that's going to go on in the Deerfield area in response to that. And so that'll be interesting. But will it truly be a cumulative effects assessment? Will it really look at that impact over time? Does it have any information about the way it was before the installation? No. Is it really aggressively doing anything now in a comprehensive way? I doubt it. And will it really bravely look to the future and anticipate all the negative consequences? There, too, I'm not confident. So, you know, with all due respect to my biology colleagues, they'll do a short, quick project, and they'll learn a few things. But, I'm afraid that they're not really doing here in Vermont what I think we should be doing. I think we should be doing, and this may be involving scientists from all over the region, not just Vermont. In other words, in order to really measure these impacts, you really need the top names in the business, and you really need to look at it quantitatively over time and spatially. It's just, it's huge, but it's a new science. It's a new paradigm. It's not unlike conservation biology was, you know, 30 years ago. Just the name, conservation biology and conservation planning. These are cutting-edge concepts that are very holistic and very comprehensive, and they're costly, and they're kind of problematic.
But we'll probably pick this up after our little break, but shouldn't there be a precautionary principle? If the studies aren't done, whether it's a noise study for adverse health impacts on a human, or it's a longitudinal, long-term migratory pattern study by a biologist to understand how these large wind turbine power plants on ridgelines are impacting the wildlife. I mean, there should be a moratorium, shouldn't there? I mean,
absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're going to go to our little break here. I have some announcements, public service announcements. When we come back, I hope we'll get some callers. We'll take some questions and we'll continue our conversation.
What's that sound? It's the sound of your money gone with the wind. It's the sound of Abercrombie's undersea cable disaster. The governor and Hawaiian Electric want you to pay 65% of the cost to build over 200 huge wind turbines, each over 40 stories high on Lanai and Molokai. The governor and Hawaiian Electric want you to pay for their $1 billion undersea cable to bring wind power to Oahu from Lanai and Molokai. This $1 billion cable will cost every residential ratepayer on Oahu at least $1,500 for the next 20 years, on top of your already rising electric bill. And your tax bill, $650 million. One quarter of the entire island of Lanai and over 11,000 acres of Molokai will be permanently disfigured. Go to friendsoflanai.org and ialohamolokai.com to learn more. Contact your state legislators and the governor's office. Tell them you don't want your money to be gone with the wind.
Please join the people around the world who have written and testified to expose the junk science in the Massachusetts Wind Science Panel Report. WindWise Massachusetts reminds listeners that the deadline to email comments to the Massachusetts DEP is tomorrow at 5 p.m., Let the DEP know it cannot accept the report as the basis for regulations or guidelines inciting industrial wind turbines in Massachusetts. The email link can be found at windwisema.org.
The Vermont Playwrights Circle presents Winds of Change, a new play written by Leslie Becker. When a powerful utility company offers a farmer who's come to hard times a sweet deal to lease the mountain behind his farm, the farmer takes the offer, and life is changed forever for the family and the town. The first act is set before the industrial wind power plant is built, and the second act is during time when the first wind turbine is turned on. The play will be read Tuesday, March 27th at 7 p.m. at the Lost Nation Theater Lobby in Montpelier. Admission is free.
Here we go again. Members of the U.S. Senate Finance Committee are trying to extend the production tax credit for 2 years. Call, fax, or email your senators and urge them to vote no on S-2201 and any other attempt to renew this massive wind energy subsidy.
Wind power is sustainable. It burns no fossil fuels. It produces no air pollution. What's more, it cuts down on dependency on foreign oil. That's what the people of Meredith in upstate New York first thought when a wind developer looked to supplement the rural farm town's failing economy with a farm of their own, that of 40 industrial wind turbines. Windfall documents how this proposal divided Meredith's residents as they fought over the future of their community. The movie will be shown 3 times in Montpelier, Vermont, as part of the Green Mountain Film Festival coming up. Friday, March 23rd at 4:15 at the Savoy Theater downstairs. Those tickets are going fast. On Saturday, March 24th at 6:15 p.m. at the Pavilion Auditorium with discussion. And on Sunday, March 25th at 12:15 p.m. at the Savoy Theater. Please buy all of your wind proponent friends a pair of tickets.
In Toronto, Ontario, on Tuesday, April 3rd, there will be a wind power convention protest. Gathering will be at 11:30 a.m., speakers at 12, protest march at 12:30 p.m. beside the CBC building, opposite Metro Toronto Convention Center, where the FIT, Fleecing Individual Taxpayers, convention is being held. Local groups, please coordinate buses and attendance for your own areas.
This is WWR, WindWise Radio. If your group has an announcement they'd like read on the show, please send them along, and we'd be happy to help. Well, we are back. I just wanted to say one thing about one of those announcements. That second showing of Windfall in Montpelier, Vermont, there are going to be a couple of the people that actually were filmed for the movie Windfall in the town of Meredith, they're going to be there for a discussion. And I think that's going to really be interesting for the people that make it there. And I hope they bring all of their windy friends with them. So I have a caller on the line. This is Chris from Pocosset. And we're going to bring him on and we'll see what his comments and questions are. So, Chris, if you can hear me, where are you calling from? Pocosset?
Cassett, Massachusetts.
From Massachusetts. And how are
Cape Cod.
On Cape Cod. How are you doing this evening?
Good, good. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What is your question, Chris?
Well, I just wanted to point out that the big problem we're all faced with is the fact that the majority of people, I think 90%, falsely believe that wind energy has value. In fact, those of us who understand science and engineering know they have no value. They don't produce anything that is of value. They do not save any fossil fuel. They do not reduce carbon emissions, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, all of the major environmental groups like Green Peace and Sierra Club, et cetera, are all falsely supporting all of this. And until we're able to educate the public and the people to start realizing that all of this destruction that these ladies are pointing out to is for nothing in return, we're really just not going to have much progress.
Well, I'd like to respond to that. I think that as much as all of the people would be great to educate, I think that we have to start with our president. And President Obama and his Energy Secretary Chu and Interior Secretary Salazar are the ones that are leading this. And so we have in Vermont, Governor Shumlin and Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Patrick Leahy, Representative Peter Welch, they are all buying into this. And so as much as we can educate the public, I think that what we really need to do is educate our elected officials, and it starts at the president's level, because we have seen every federal agency roll over for this. Yeah. And it feels really, I mean, we could have everybody in Vermont opposing it, but if the people in power want it, then what we're seeing is that's what's happening. So we're moving from a democracy to a dictatorship as in terms of wind energy, where the voices of the people are not only not being heard, they're not even interested in hearing from us.
Well, and I will add to that, with all due respect, I think that I would look to our leadership in Washington and Montpelier, for example, any capital of any New England state to really try to find creative ways to empower people to do the right thing. And it all starts with conservation. I mean, we could save 20% of the energy we're going to use in the next 20 years simply by not using it. And that's called efficiency. And there is no question that that can happen. And, you know, I'm proud of America sometimes because, you know, we can do it. But the people really need packages and scenarios that really do engage them in meaningful ways in making those sacrifices willingly, proudly, knowing that it's going to have a positive effect. There's none of that going on. It's all about empowering yet another industry infrastructure to distribute electricity. And I don't get it. It's much, much
well,
bigger than
I guess I'm more cynical than that. I still believe that the politicians will respond to the majority of the people, and the majority of the people are against us. We got to turn that around somehow.
Well, I don't know that the majority of the people are against us. I think there are a lot of politicians and industrial leaders that are against us, but I think the majority of the people would be horrified if they went up on Low Mountain and saw what we were doing up there. I can't think of anybody.
Yeah, they're horrified about all that, but they're also horrified that they're going to drown here on Cape Cod in 20 years because, you know, Al Gore says that we're going to have a 20-foot rise in the sea. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we really have to point out and say, you know, it's just not true, and we're not getting any value for the money we're doing. Actually, it's counterproductive because we're not focusing on real alternatives.
Right, we're putting a lot of energy into opposing a bad technology. Where what I've said to some of the politicians is, look, I have an army, and they're all spending a lot of energy working against something. You know,
yeah.
Stop pushing this technology and let's promote and work on what we can do, which is lighting up our houses and doing solar hot water and solar photovoltaics and really doing the things that are easy first, and then consider if somebody can actually make the case that these big machines make a difference. So we are at a place.
Well, I don't think anybody can make that case. Anyway, I'll sign off. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
So, yeah, I think we lose sight sometimes of just trying to reestablish a conversation about the values of what we're about. You know, what is the value of a mountain range? What are we going to hold dear? And what should be a last resort? And we start to prioritize things based on those things rather than our comfort level. Can we have a big screen TV or whatnot? You know, it just seems to me like some of that is in order here. Where do Ben and Jerry fall down on this? I mean,
They're busy going after the corporations, so they are working with VPIRG to say that the Citizens United Supreme Court case was bad. They don't seem to have made that connection to the fact that it's corporations that are the ones that are profiting at taxpayer expense from these big wind projects. And really, the green that we're seeing is very clearly the green that comes from political donations to the politicians. So, for instance, the largest political donor to our current governor is David Blitterstorff and his All Earth Renewables and NRG systems. President Obama was influenced by Lawrence Summers and Rahm Emanuel, both of whom have connections to First Wind's financing. And so when you start looking at who has access to the politicians, are the ones that are, there with the money. And so that's really what we're challenged by. It's really not even about the technology so much as it is about who they're listening to because they're buying access.
That's a really good point.
Well, again, I
just wanted to let you guys know we have another caller, Jessica from Northfield, Vermont, who has a question for you too. Jessica, are you on? Can you hear us, Jessica?
Yes, hi, I am.
Go ahead.
I just want to thank you so much for all the work you're doing and to just kind of support and ask for your comments on the concept you were talking about, information that our political officials are lacking. And I think a couple of concepts they're missing are this idea of life cycle analysis and throughput. And so, you know, they're really feeling like they need green energy, but they're not realizing that the amount of energy that is giving off from these wind projects is actually less than what's really being taken away through mining the metal and transporting it and the petroleum, not to mention the roads. And then all these life support systems of all the creatures and lichen and algae and water and air and all the earth systems being disturbed, that they're not realizing that. And I think that's a lack in the education system, and somehow if they had that awareness, potentially they wouldn't be able to, and if all of the public, if we all were living that, I feel it would become clearer to people. I'm just curious your reflections on.
Thank you so much for saying that. That's really the crux of it. My great hero in life and mentor in a way, certainly ideologically, is Aldo Leopold. And in one of his many brilliant essays, he posited that really the destruction of the environment, we're not going to stop doing that. We're not going to stop making excuses for doing that, which is certainly what we're doing now with the alleged green energy that we're going to produce through, so-called clean coal or wind tower facilities on mountains, on non-renewable ridgelines, if you will. But my point is this, and his point, is it really is unethical when we destroy the environment the way we continually make excuses for ourselves to go ahead and do for whatever reason, over hundreds of years, we've always had a perfectly logical excuse for why we should destroy the environment. Well, we can't do
there's
that
always anymore. There's always a reason for exploitation, it seems.
Yeah. Well, now, here's one of the really stunning things to me. We have, in Vermont, a public service board, and it's three people appointed by the governor. And they are charged with the technical hearings and deciding whether or not there's a public good. The process involves a site visit, and it involves a public hearing, and then it's some really highly litigious technical hearings. This public service board did not go up on the Lowell Mountains to see what it looked like. They drove around in a bus, but they actually didn't go to the site. None of the decision makers actually ever went to the mountain to see what is there. And all you have to do is go there to see the, I mean, talk about moose. There's moose dropping everywhere. It is a mountain that it was full of life, bare-scarred trees everywhere. I mean, water dripping off of moss and rocks covered with moss. Such an alive place. And I think it's a real crime to, in the process, to allow the process to go on without the decision makers ever even setting foot on the land.
Yeah.
Well, of course, our agency biologists, who are themselves important decision makers, and many of them are fine biologists, says something has got to be done to give these people the freedom they need to really let their conscience speak. I mean, I don't know. I'm wondering what's going on here because our biologists are good in Vermont, and I don't understand why they're going along with this. And that's my perspective on the subject.
Well, now, the attitude of one of them on the witness stand was that they're worried about housing developments and that housing developments are so much more destructive than this sort of thing. But, of course, we have Act 50 in Vermont. You can't put a housing development up on a mountain.
No.
But that was justification that was articulated.
So that's another false, like, argument. I mean, you're never going to get a housing development in under Article 248, which is the public good thing, right, where what you have in Vermont, as I understand it.
Yeah, that's just for energy projects. That's Section 248.
Right, so you'll never get one of those. So it's kind of really a false argument to say, but the alternative is, you know, that we're going to have all these housing developments on the top of the Lowell Mountains, and that's never going to happen. The alternative is that you're going to leave the mountain alone, and it's going to be in its beautiful natural state and do all the things that it's supposed to do. Support wildlife, support groundwater filtration, all that stuff that it's, you know, been beautifully designed by nature to do.
Well, if I could be so extreme, I'd like to propose that really what we need to do from our loftiest politicians in the highest places in Washington and our capital cities is we really need to define where we humans are willing to restrict ourselves, willing to make sacrifices, willing to live differently, and willing to accommodate the rest of life on the planet. And that starts now. Not tomorrow, not 10 years from now, now. And for that reason, I say we cannot and should not violate any more wild habitats in the world. Not in Vermont, not in the Lowell Mountains, not anywhere. There's so little of that left. And it's time for our species to learn to live with the rest of life. And that's what our leadership should be fully aware of and fully behind. Of course, that's not true, and you and I know it, but that's really what we're talking about.
Well, bless you for saying that, because I agree with you so much. And, I mean, it's really well said, really well said. We're coming down to the very end here, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this question, because I'd like to get an update on what's happening with the litigation that I know that Vermonters for a Clean Environment's involved in the National Forest there. What's the status of all that, Annette, and how do you see that proceeding?
Well, we're currently in the administrative appeal. The U.S. Forest Service issued its approval. It had to issue a special use permit for what's called the Deerfield Wind Project, which is a project that would be built by Iberdrola, the large Spanish utility that's also doing the Hoosac wind project in just about 10 miles south in Massachusetts. Not only did Vermonters for a Clean Environment file an appeal, but also Defenders of Wildlife joined with the Wilderness Society and Green Berkshires to appeal. And I heard recently that also the Green Mountain Club and the Appalachian Trail Society also appealed. And so did the town of Wilmington. Now, those appeals go to the regional forester who's out in Milwaukee, and he will issue a decision apparently on April 9th. And then that is the end of the process through which the U.S. Forest Service allows appeals. My organization is preparing to go into federal court and litigate over violations of NEPA and the Wilderness Act and some other laws. I mean, this the environmental impact study done on this project is riddled with conflict of interest and bias that really should be embarrassing to the U.S. Forest Service. So we are we don't like to litigate. It is not our first choice at all, but it's something that we've stepped up to do because somebody's got to do it. The precedents that would be set would pretty much enable any Forest Service land to be used for wind projects and also threaten every wilderness area in the country.
It's a very dangerous trend. The BLM lands out west that are being opened up, or they're attempting to do it. The take permits that they're starting to try to get issued for Golden Eagle takes surrounding some of the western wind farms, wind power plants, sorry, and also the Gallitzin State Forest, a state forest in western Pennsylvania that's under the similar threat. And there's widespread sort of, seems to me, dangerous precedents be set about using these public lands that were set aside for a completely different reason in order to give them to, like, a company from Spain, and along with a huge sum of our tax dollars. Doesn't make much any sense to me. Let me, we're really running out of time. I want to ask both of you just quickly to sum up, and what can people do to help? What can they do to help you guys with your organizations and in your efforts?
Well, I think each and every person listening to us this evening really needs to just get on the telephone, get on the computer, and write to his or her legislator or multiple legislators and say, you know, this has got to stop, whether it's in Massachusetts or Connecticut or Vermont or New Hampshire or New York. I mean, this battle is huge, and it's only starting. And it's not going to stop until we have a real critical mass of citizens really just saying, hey, you know, I'm not in approval of this. We need to stop. I think they might respond to that. Organizations like ours, fighting it by ourselves, may not be successful without a whole lot of public support.
Okay. And that's all very good advice. And I would just add to it, relationships are a lot about, you know, how to get things done and who you know. So especially if you know people in power, especially if you know people who are close to the governors who are supporting this. And then I would add that it's very important now, I think, for people to start writing to the president, because this is going on all over the country. And I noticed today a lot of the news stories are indicating that the president's energy policy is now coming under attack from the Republicans. And I think that it's as much as I want to support this president, until he shows some evidence that he's listening to the really millions of people who are affected by these wind projects all over the country and starts hearing us, we are, you know, it's hard to support him.
And although our alternatives seem pretty grim too, but
that's right. Yeah. So, and just as it is, take personal responsibility, insulate your house, don't drive so much, stay home, invest in solar panels, and invest in solar hot water. Solar works. Go solar.
Yeah, there's no question that if we were to decisively do these things now, and I might add to be led properly to do them and even help where needed, we could save way more than 20% of the energy we're currently using. Right now, the wind energy and the idea that you can just keep that switch working and keep using all your stuff and everything's perfectly okay, that's not an appropriate vision for the future. We really do need to make sacrifices. We do need to change. We do need to improve how our homes are heated and how we travel so as to not leave such a devastating impact on the planet. And those are choices that we're going to have to make. Now, 20 years from now, take your pick. But we could do conservation now in an aggressive way and efficiency now and buy ourselves the time we need to fully research all these other alternative energy paths that truly will be green, because we'll know that. But right now, we don't know that. And so why are we rushing into this?
That is a great, great summary. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much, Sue and Annette, for coming on to the show. We are so honored to have you. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
It always goes so fast. It always goes very fast. So next week, what's on, Susan?
I believe next week we're going to have Lisa Lanois.
No. That's the week after, right?
Oh, my goodness. Right. Next week is Maine. We're going to have folks from Maine.
So it's going to be Dr. Monique Aniel. We're going to have Steve Thurston. And also one of the Maine's master guides, David Corrigan, is going to be with us to talk about what's happening in the wilds of Maine. So until that time, we're going to say goodnight and best of luck.